state of anarchy, and Flint's city manager accused him of treason. Murphy's vision of a just world caused him to lose his bid for re-election. But the strength of his convictions and leadership placed him in national positions almost immediately. As U.S. Attorney General from 1939 to 1940, he established the Civil Liberties Section of the Criminal Division of the Justice Department. And after FDR appointed him to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1940, Murphy championed outsiders, underdogs, minorities, and the underserved. In 1944, in his dissenting opinion in Falbo v. United States, he wrote lines that have inspired my belief in government as a force for good. The law knows no finer hour than when it cuts through formal concepts and transitory emotions to protect unpopular citizens against discrimination and persecution. On behalf of another group of unpopular citizens, he referred to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II as the legalization of racism in his dissenting opinion in Korematsu v. United States. The first justice to ever use the word racism in a Supreme Court opinion, he went on to employ it 7 more times before it disappeared from court opinions for 2 decades. Throughout his short life, when he died at 59, thousands of newly organized workers and union members lined the streets of Detroit to pay their respects. Murphy showed tremendous courage. In 1925 to 1926, when he was a judge, well before he achieved national recognition, he presided over what was billed as the trial of the century. A black physician in Detroit, Dr. Ossian Sweet, had dared to move his family from the black ghetto to an all-white working-class neighborhood. Racist whites attacked and invaded Sweet's home. One of the rioters, a white man, was killed in self-defense, and Dr. Sweet was charged with murder. To defend him, the NAACP brought in the great trial lawyer and showman Clarence Darrow, famous for his defense of Eugene v. Debs in the 1894 Pullman Railway strike. Judge Murphy, feeling that the trial would be an important test of justice and liberalism, assigned himself to the case, which led eventually to Dr. Sweet's acquittal. A battle for justice was won, but the rest of the story isn't so happy. Dr. Sweet's notoriety led to the deaths of several family members and ended his career in medicine. The grand bargain and the prosperity of the post-war years expanded the middle class, but also meant more housing stock was needed, especially those cookie-cutter starter homes that people wanted to live in. The suburbs became an easy answer. GM launched a strategy of acquiring large swaths of land in the emerging areas around Flint, where taxes were lower. It would build plants there, modern manufacturing facilities, and at the same time solve the housing crisis. The suburban exodus of manufacturing resulted in a suburban exodus of residents. That exodus was mostly white, particularly during the fractious early days of school desegregation and busing. First, the Supreme Court outlawed racial housing covenants, and then came its 1954 Brown v. Board of Education decision desegregating schools. The momentous 1967 riots in Detroit and Flint seemed to scar whites with images of rebellion and destruction. Flint citizens passed a groundbreaking fair housing ordinance in February 1968 by 43 votes, followed just a few months later by President Lyndon Johnson's Federal Fair Housing Act. Together, these events left Flint reeling from the effects of extreme white flight. When an African-American family moved into a neighborhood, often in the face of intimidation and threats, white families moved out en masse, anxious that their property values would decrease. Greedy real estate agents colluded to control neighborhoods in what came to be called blockbusting. Real estate agents would go door to door, frightening whites with warnings of plummeting home values and offering to put their homes on the market quickly, often below market prices. The agents then sold the homes to African Americans at a large markup above market prices. The scam continued at the banks, which charged blacks a higher interest rate. The upward mobility that white Americans took for granted in the second half of the 20th century was denied to most blacks. But blockbusting, which continued into the 1970s, kept it out of reach even longer. Worried about the city's future vitality and population, some city leaders, institutions, and entities, from GM to the UAW and the Mott Foundation, backed a 1968 referendum to bind the city and its suburbs to a regional government. The first effort had been made prior to white flight, as far back as 1958. Cities in the South and the West grow geographically by annexing suburbs, as in metropolitan Los Angeles, where suburban expansion didn't jeopardize the tax and economic base of downtown. But the residents in Flint's new suburbs, happily ensconced in their new houses and all-white neighborhoods, voted overwhelmingly against the referendum. The ramifications of this missed opportunity were grave and enduring. Flint was left isolated and abandoned, comprising only a bit more than its urban core. Attempts to desegregate Michigan's public schools met with even more white voter anger and violence throughout the 1960s and 70s. The school busing wars raged, culminating in the bombing of school buses in Pontiac in 1971. Finally, in 1974, the Supreme Court issued a decision that kids couldn't be bused across city lines. That decision, if it had gone the other way, could have integrated my hometown of Royal Oak with kids bused in from Detroit. Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote in his dissent to Milliken v. Bradley that the court's refusal to remedy separate and unequal education leaves little hope that our people will learn to live together and understand each other. The downward trends continued in Flint after the failure of Autoworld in 1984. Leaders came and went, more GM plants closed, many people left seeking jobs and warmer climates. As an urban center, Flint has been in a man-made state of emergency for 40 years. Today, pockets of old money affluence remain in Flint, but you can also buy a house here for less than $30,000. And I'm talking about a decent house, similar to the Royal Oak home where I grew up. The national poverty rate is about 16%. But in Flint, almost 60% of children live in poverty, some in extreme poverty. Unemployment, unheard of in the city's glory days, is now epidemic. Violence has also taken a toll. There were 48 killings in Flint in 2015. Including 42 gun deaths and an additional 147 non-fatal shootings. The population of Flint peaked at 200,000, but is now less than half that, which means thousands of abandoned homes, plummeting property values, and far less tax revenue. When the state of Michigan cut revenue sharing, the city starved even more. When I returned to Flint to work at Hurley in 2011, a new glimmer of revitalization was underway, with a few new restaurants, an enhanced downtown, and a new program of blight removal. But given all the city's challenges, it was just that, a glimmer. Even as a girl, I had guessed that places are more complicated and nuanced than a sentence or one explanation can offer. That has proven true. No single bad decision or unfortunate event created modern Flint. The greatest forces working against the city were racism and the corporate greed of GM, which pulled out of Flint, the city that birthed and nurtured it, to satisfy financial problems caused by a lack of imagination. But half-hearted, weakly enforced policies like desegregation and the premature end of the Great Society also played a role, along with deindustrialization and real estate greed. What drew me to Flint and has kept me here was something else I saw, something that made me think of my dad and mom, of the family stories I'd heard, it was the tenacity and endurance of its people, the passion of its strikers and workers, and its legacy of steel-plated grit and resilience. When Rick Snyder decided to run for governor in 2010, Flint was bleeding money, just as it was bleeding people and taxpayers. He campaigned as a moderate and a can-do guy. A former businessman, he had been the chief operating officer at now-defunct Gateway Computers. When Acer acquired Gateway in 2007, he left the company and kept busy as a venture capitalist, selling a healthcare firm for $200 million to Johnson & Johnson. With his practicality and financial know-how, Snyder vowed to make Michigan government work like a business. While his focus on metrics and calls for relentless positive action always sounded creepy and vaguely cultish to me, there was definitely hope when he was elected that he might join the ranks of other successful Republican moderates, like George Romney and William Milliken, who governed Michigan fairly and successfully. But almost from the start, a sinking sense of disappointment in Snyder set in. He wasn't a moderate at all, or at least he didn't govern like one. Almost immediately, the Tea Party started pushing him to the right, and then he just kept going in that direction. Governor Snyder's enthusiasm for the emergency manager law seemed totally genuine and unforced, not something he was pushed to do by the Tea Party or anyone else. One of the first bills he signed was Public Act 4, a beefed-up version of a prior EM law that allowed him to take over a municipality that was beset with financial problems. Even though Michigan voters shot down Public Act 4 in a referendum, the ideologues in the legislature ignored the voters and passed the law again 1 month later. The appointed EM had one job, extreme austerity. Someone called Snyder's EM scheme austerity by dictator. The EM had to balance the books no matter the cost. The EM law has so many miserable aspects, it's hard to know where to start. City employees and their pensions and benefits were a primary target. The extreme austerity, which was also behind the water switch, decimated Flint's police force. Between 2008 and 2016, it shrank from 265 sworn personnel to 98. Selling off city resources was also part of the grand plan. The EM law also allowed for the privatization of public institutions, even possibly Hurley Medical Center. By the time I got deep into the water crisis, three different Flint EMs had come and gone, each lasting only a short while. It didn't really matter who they were anyway. The governor's office in Lansing was calling the shots. Chapter 10, Jenny and the Data. The lack of response from the state, specifically the health department, sent me into a dark hole. I just didn't get it. Just as I began to fall into despair, Elin wrote to me with good news. For the last week, she had been working behind the scenes, quietly, like a spider spinning a web. The first strand in her trap was marshaling political support. Elin was working as a water policy analyst for a Washington-based nonpartisan think tank, the Northeast Midwest Institute, where she was finishing up a massive report on fracking, a project that had kept her in regular communication with members of Congress, including the office of Dan Kildee, who represented Flint. She got in touch with Kildee's office to share her concerns about Flint water and passed along my name and number to a staff member. Elin's view all along was that the D.C. crisis had been prolonged and worsened because the district lacked congressional representation. For all Flint's problems, we at least had congressional representation. If Representative Kildee could be brought in, made aware of the lead levels in Flint, we'd have more clout and more options. I didn't know much about Kildee, except that he'd succeeded his uncle, Dale Kildee, who had been the congressman for the Flint area for almost four decades and had been an old-school New Dealer. Even if the nephew had gotten into office by trading on his locally famous name and had nothing else going for him, any congressman who represented and lived in Flint would surely have to help. The controversy over the water switch had been bubbling for a while now. Some of his constituents were definitely mad, and hopefully they were also contacting his office with concerns. Sure enough, after a brief email exchange, Jordan Dickerson, Kildee's legislative director on Capitol Hill, called me to talk. He sounded young, earnest, and thanks to Elin, already well-informed. He knew about the Del Toro memo, the pushback from the EPA, the lack of a response from the state agencies, and that I was looking at my kid's blood lead levels. He asked what I knew so far and what I needed. Quickly, I spelled out my request. The county and state collected children's blood lead levels for all of Flint. Could Representative Kildee's office help me get them? To do the science right, we needed that large sample. After so much silence and feeling like I was shouting into the wind, I was greatly relieved to hear excitement in Jordan's voice. He was on board and had the complete support of his boss. Better yet, he couldn't wait to get started. Elin sent along news of another big development. Mark Edwards and a Virginia Tech research team had more results posted online from extensive citizen water testing in Flint. In case there was any doubt about the urgency of the city's water situation, the headline of Edwards' report was bold and in all caps. If it were spoken, it would have been yelling. Flint has a very serious lead in water problem. The numbers were pretty dramatic. 40% of the first draw samples are over 5 parts per billion, or PPB. That is 101 out of 252 water samples from Flint homes had first-draw lead more than 5 ppb. The report went on to say that several samples exceeded 100 ppb, and one sample that was collected after flushing exceeded 1,000 ppb. No level of lead is actually safe, but this meant a significant number of households had levels above the federal action level of 15 ppb. Those are scary numbers, sure to shock anybody with any knowledge of the consequences of lead as a neurotoxin. Until further notice, Edwards recommended that Flint water be used for cooking and drinking only if filtered first or after the tap was run for a full 5 minutes at a high flow rate. Elin and I texted back and forth, horrified by the numbers and wondering how the state would react. Can they really keep ignoring this? Both Dean Dean and Elin wrote with the news, according to MLive, that Edwards was returning to Flint the following week and was scheduled to appear at a town meeting on the evening of September 15th at Saints of God Church on Forest Hill Avenue. I added the town meeting to the calendar for my community pediatric residents. Then I wrote to Elin, "I think we should meet him." She called immediately, something she did only when she had too much to say and didn't have the patience to type out her response. "All the water people are afraid of him," she said. "Should I be?" Elin used words like "too intense" and "radioactive" to describe Edwards, saying that he didn't play nice and seemed willing to attack almost anyone. If we wanted to convince state authorities to get on the right side of this issue, any connection to him could backfire. His battles with the EPA, the CDC, WASA, and the DC government were notorious in water circles and had sparked continuing investigations, hearings, and court cases. It had been a long and painful decade fighting governments and water utilities to root out lead from their water, an uphill battle that had left Edwards, according to things Elin had heard, emotionally and psychologically damaged. I Googled Edwards while Elin and I talked. Wow, he even had a Wikipedia page. As soon as she and I said goodbye, I dug into it thoroughly. The page described the truly awful story of the DC crisis and listed Edwards' various papers, awards, and accolades. I wasn't really sure what a MacArthur Fellow was, so I clicked on the link to that website and found the page that described the Genius Award he'd received in 2007. Mark Edwards, a civil engineer, is playing a vital role in ensuring the safety of drinking water and in exposing deteriorating water delivery infrastructure in America's largest cities. An expert in the chemistry and toxicity of urban water supplies in the United States, he has made significant advancements in a broad array of areas, including arsenic removal, coagulation of natural organic material, and the causes and control of copper and lead corrosion in new and aging distribution systems. Melding rigorous science, concern for public safety, and dogged investigation, Edwards' recent work focused on the identification and analysis of lead contamination in the Washington, D.C. area's local water supply. I discovered that money came with a MacArthur Award and wondered if Edwards had been able to pay off the second mortgage that Elon said he'd taken out to cover the costs of his own research in D.C. Who was paying for his work in Flint? It had to be pricey to travel 500 miles with all these grad students time and time again. A few photos were offered at the bottom of his MacArthur Foundation page. There he was, scary Mark. Except he didn't look radioactive. Angular and chiseled, the guy was seriously handsome. As if he should be starring in a movie about water, not testing it himself. I couldn't help but notice the bizarre necktie he was wearing. It was way too wide and had a couple of baby panda bears with really sad-looking faces on it. Who was dressing this man? Was he for real? How could you take a man in a panda tie seriously, much less find him scary? But apparently, everybody in the water world did. I focused again on the blood lead data from my clinic. Kay Taylor, the head of Hurley Research, had answered my frantic email within an hour with an equally urgent reply. Bless her. Kay has always been so supportive, and she epitomizes everything I love about working at Hurley. Such a passionate, altruistic, and lean place to treat patients and train new doctors. Compared to other teaching hospitals, our research department isn't that big, just a handful of staff. But we're nimble and scrappy and always evolving to meet the research needs of my residents and faculty. Kay assigned a research coordinator, Jenny LaChance, to help me. Jenny and I had previously worked together on tight deadlines for grant applications and research projects and had known each other since I was a medical student at Hurley. We were a good team. I love crunching numbers and trying to harness the power of data, but Jenny took that passion to a whole new level. Smart, logical, super scientific, and verging on obsessive, she loves nothing more than designing a foolproof study and figure out the best way to collect and analyze data. Jenny could talk your ear off about power and sample size, positive predictive value, statistical significance, and absolute risk reduction, among other esoteric subjects. I left work early that day to take Elliot for another opinion about his shoulder. Along the way, as I weaved through Metro Detroit traffic, we talked mostly about the girls. They were in the middle of their first week of school and settling in fine. Homework was light. There was soccer practice, but no games yet. Other parents were helping with carpooling, and Elliot's parents were bringing over the occasional meal. As we got deeper into the logistics of soccer and meals, I mentally checked out, thinking about a dozen other lead-related things. A pang of guilt brought me back to the car, and I forced myself to think about home life again. In the waiting room, I tried to catch up on the glut of half-ignored emails that were taking over my inbox. Questions from my pediatric residents, scheduling dates for nutrition education meetings, motivational interview training, following up on a new resident from India who'd gotten in a car accident just a day after getting her driver's license, and more back-and-forth banter with Roebuck about the new software tool that the IT folks were embedding in our EMR to help residents safely hand over patients between shifts. "Your peeps are awesome. Give them a hug for me," I wrote to Roebuck. He replied, "IT nerds don't hug. Makes them uncomfortable. Instead, we spread out our fingers and either say, live long and prosper, or nanu nanu. I called an urgent meeting for the next morning, September 9th, with Jenny and my team of community pediatrics residents. I explained my hypothesis that lead in the Flint tap water had ended up in the bodies of our children. Assembled around the rows of tables and chairs in our pediatric classroom, adjacent to my office, we pulled up the raw labs, the unfiltered data from patients' charts, on the conference room screen. A quick glance at the numbers on the screen, before and after the water switch, appeared to show an increase, but I couldn't give just a quick look and be certain, the way I might quickly look at the itchy bumps on a young patient's legs and the miserable look in her eyes and immediately identify a rash as scabies. Look, here are the classic signs, the pathognomonic burrows. Analyzing data requires a nuanced approach and much more time. As I had learned as an undergraduate and later in medical school, a good study needs to take into consideration an array of factors to get the science right, then must be carefully designed for accuracy and clarity. Numbers may appear to be black and white and simple, but they have a way of hiding secrets if a study and analysis aren't properly done. A lot of thinking goes into a study, and often there are many revisions, times when you have to start all over from scratch. In our meeting, we discussed the kinds of questions that researchers have: how to collect information, how to organize or group the data, and what should be included or excluded. For instance, we had blood lead levels for children of different ages. Should we lump them all together or limit the age range to children under 5, since they are the most developmentally vulnerable? As we looked at the numbers, we realized we had no idea where these kids lived. They had come to our Flint clinic, but did they even get Flint water? Jenny and I searched on zipcode.org for Flint and decided to use 48501 through 48507 on our dataset. I wrote to Elin to ask if the water supply went just to Flint or beyond the boundaries of the city. Then I wrote back to IT and asked if they could run the numbers again, including zip codes, in the report. I heard back just a few minutes later. That's the miracle of electronic medical records. So much time goes into crunching or into fine-tuning and designing a study. But once you ask the right questions, spitting out the results happens in an instant. We were far from finished with the fine-tuning process. We still had other things to sort out, like how to filter out repeats, patients who were in our system twice because their lead levels were measured twice in our time period. And when we saw a super high lead level reported, should we look individually at each of those patient charts to see what the determined cause was? If we saw that the child had eaten paint chips, should we exclude them from the study? We knew we'd be doing the research twice, for data sets on lead levels before the water switch and after. But how are we going to break up the time periods? Should we look at a date immediately after the water switch, or should there be a lag time for the leaching of lead? How long did it take for the leaching to occur? The residents began pulling up research on their laptops. As I spoke, their focus on me was intense, and I could see their minds were fully engaged. Most of the research that medical students and residents do is important, but academic. One special report of a rare case of encephalitis, or a study of patterns of treatments that happened years ago in other places, other hospitals. But here we were, talking about lead poisoning, lead exposure, and blood lead levels. In numbers from the previous year and over the summer, numbers from just a couple of days ago. It was real, something that was happening all around us, the blood of our own patients, and water that flowed in the pipes of our own city, where we sat. The residents were engaged in a way I'd rarely seen before, vibrating with a weird new energy, tense but invigorated by the feeling that we were finally doing something, and our results weren't going to be stuffed away in a digital archive and forgotten. Our results could change our world. The residents eagerly pulled up related literature and the electronic charts of some of the kids with the highest lead levels. Oh, this one says there was peeling paint in their house. Or, this one doesn't mention a potential source. Another said, this kid was shot. Bullets left lead in the bloodstream too. We decided to look only at kids 5 and younger, to look at only one level per child, the highest level, and to include all kids no matter what was in their chart as a potential source. As for time period, we agreed that we'd look at an equal length of time before and after the water switch, January 1st, 2013, to April 24th, 2014, versus April 25th, 2014, to September 9th, 2015. Jenny took careful notes on her laptop while we talked and said she'd have something soon, even by tomorrow. I knew from our other projects together that, like me, Jenny wasn't a 9-to-5-er. Once she got going on something, she took it home and kept working. Putting a study together was like working on a jigsaw puzzle. It was kind of addictive, hard to stop, and offered a dopamine hit of pleasure when you reached the end. When the meeting finished, the residents filtered out of the room to see patients in the clinic. They were silent, deep in thought. I had tasked them with overnight assignments, looking up more literature on lead exposure, finding similar studies, taking a deeper dive in a number of areas we needed to know more about. They knew this work loomed large for me, for the clinic, and for all of us, but especially for our patients and our community. We would be fashioning an argument out of blood tests, numbers, and zip codes. When the last resident left, I noticed Jenny hanging back, waiting to talk to me. She had a few questions, she said, and I could tell they were personal. She had a look on her face that wasn't about numbers. It's the same look I see on every parent's face who comes to the clinic worried about her kids. It was about Drew, her baby son. He was just a year old and still nursing. Jenny wanted to know, if she was drinking Flint tap water at the hospital, could she be passing along lead to him in her breast milk? She was using a breast pump and sending bottles of it along to his daycare in Grand Blanc, a suburb south of Flint. I knew this was the kind of question all the parents and caregivers in Flint would have once they knew what we suspected, including all the moms who worked with us in the clinic. Aside from coffee and tea or whatever I get at the cafeteria, Jenny said, I haven't been drinking the water at work. As a Flint native, she had been alarmed like everybody else when the city's water source was switched to the river. And when she saw the early news reports of water quality issues, she had the luxury of taking extra precautions, even bringing bottles of tap water from her home, which was outside Flint. I assured her that all those protective steps were good, and she should keep doing them. But what about when I was pregnant with Drew? She asked. I could see her calculating the date of the water switch in relation to her pregnancy. Drew was born in August 2014, 5 months after the Flint River started flowing out of the tap. A look of worry and sadness passed across her face. That means 75% of the time I was pregnant, we were on that water, and I was coming to work every day and drinking the water. I know, I said, nodding, and then reached out to comfort her. Jenny studied my face as much as I was studying hers. Do you think Drew's okay? She asked. Is there anything else I should be doing? He's been sick a lot lately. Drew was due for a bunch of vaccines that week, she told me, but was still recovering from his first ear infection. Jenny, being an obsessive researcher, had become paranoid about antibiotics, vaccines, the germy environment of daycare, and all the other worries that can plague a parent, especially a parent let loose on the internet. So much of what we do as pediatricians is listening, reaffirming, and reassuring, especially first-time moms and dads. He'll be fine. The ear infection is a common virus. Don't worry. Daycare is good for him. All the germs will make him stronger, I told her. He does not need antibiotics, and vaccines are important. After a parade of reassurances and a tight hug, we said goodbye. And I sat alone in my office chair for a few minutes, trying to clear my head. I felt bad for Jenny, and I knew how terrible it was to have mom worries. I remembered those days. But imagine how the moms of Flint were going to feel when they did the math for themselves. And think of the ones who were pregnant, like Jenny, and were not just having an occasional cup of coffee at work, but were drinking the water all day long. How worried and angry they'd be. Who would answer to them? Early the next morning, on September 10th, Jenny texted me. True to her hard-working and somewhat obsessive style, she had already run the numbers and had completed a preliminary analysis of blood lead levels from Hurley Children's Clinic. Jenny, I got something. Me, email it. Jenny, okay, I'm coming to your office. I was sitting at my office desk when her PDF came in with the actual statistical analysis. It was just one page, easy to read and comprehend. Comparing children under 5 years of age with elevated lead levels, greater than or equal to 5 micrograms per deciliter, for about the same duration of time pre-water switch, January 1st, 2013, to April 24th, 2014, to post-water switch, April 25th, 2014, to September 9th, 2015, the percentage increased from 1.5% to 8.5%. The p-value was 0.007. In statistics, the p-value shows statistical significance. And the lower the p-value, the stronger the significance. Anything less than 0.05 is significant. There it was. Lead. It was real. The impact was there in the numbers. It was exactly what Elin had feared and what Del Toro had suspected. My clinic results showed more kids with higher lead levels since the water switch in 2014. The increase in the percentage was there, and it was big and statistically significant. But the sample was so small. 4 out of the 270 kids in the pre-period who tested high, and 6 out of 71 kids in the post-period. Jenny appeared in my office, out of breath. She sprinted down 3 flights of stairs in a hurry. Even though her cheeks were flushed, her skin looked unusually pale, and there were dark circles under her eyes. She was tired and probably hadn't slept much, having run numbers all night. We didn't even say hi or greet each other. We jumped in immediately, talking about holes in the analysis, or potential holes. One way to produce a perfect, unassailable study is to be a scientific devil's advocate. It's the way clinical reasoning works. Also, part of me was desperately hoping to find an alternative explanation for the results we were getting. I didn't want them to be true. For instance, the percentage of kids with elevated lead levels was higher and was significant, but there could be a practical explanation. What if the 6 kids with high lead levels were siblings in a family that lived in one home that was infested with lead paint? And we should have more test results or more data points. Where were they? Why were so few kids tested after the water switch compared to before the water switch? Before the switch, 270 screenings had been done. After the switch, only 71. What was going on? What I needed was a study that left no room for doubt. I needed a larger sample. And that was going to require getting records from the county or state. After I sent more persistent emails, the county health department finally said they could retrieve lead levels only one at a time by downloading a PDF for each child. Was this how they did basic public health surveillance? It was hard to imagine how these public servants slept at night. Of course, Kildee's office might come through, but it could take time. There could be delays. We need more data, Jenny. We need more... Wait a second. Hurley pretty much processes the labs for the entire county, not just for our clinic. Couldn't you just pull the numbers pretty quickly from our EMR? I will email IT right now. Hold on, Jenny said. I think we'll need to get an IRB approval for that. She was right. We did. IRB stands for Institutional Review Board. Since I was a director of the residency program at Hurley, I had the authority to review data from my own patients and patients at the Hurley Clinic, but I didn't have the power to look at data from patients outside our practice. To get access to a much bigger sample, Jenny and I would have to have a review board at Hurley give us permission. All research done on humans is protected by ethical guidelines that were established in 1979 in reaction to terrible historic incidents in which people were experimented on in cruel and exploitative ways, especially poor, disadvantaged, or mentally ill people. The infamous Tuskegee experiment that I teach my residents about, when government researchers withheld treatment from black subjects with syphilis, is a prime example of what an IRB is meant to keep from ever happening again. So while the process of getting an IRB approval could be bureaucratic and time-consuming, the principle behind it, that people are more important than any institution or system or research project, was so good, solid, and right, I couldn't complain. At a big university, it could take months for researchers to get approval for a study. Those big institutional review boards sometimes met only 4 times a year. One of the blessings of working at a small teaching hospital was how quickly we could get things done. At least we hoped. I'll give a heads up to the IRB folks, Jenny said. She worked just a couple of doors from their office. And if the stars were aligned and we busted our butts and I really pushed it, we might get an IRB approval in a week or two. Meanwhile, Brad Werfel, the rabid pit bull of MDEQ, was going after Mark Edwards. After the findings of the Virginia Tech study were posted, the local media picked up the story, which prompted MDEQ's vicious pushback. It was all over the morning news. Werfel criticized Edwards for fanning political flames irresponsibly and described his Virginia Tech team as a group that specializes in looking for high lead problems. Trash-talking the leading water expert in the country is a stupid strategy if you think about it. Werfel told the Flint Journal, "They pull that rabbit out of that hat everywhere they go. Nobody should be surprised when the rabbit comes out of the hat, even if they can't figure out how it is done." How long had it taken Werfel to polish these cute quips? If only MDEQ had spent as much time listening to the people's concerns and carefully looking at Edwards' findings as they had minimizing and dismissing them. But now that I was lying awake all night, eyes open, mind buzzing, I used the time to read all the books I'd ordered on the public health history of lead. I was beginning to see that over the last century, lead seemed to bring out the very best and the very worst in people. And I knew already which side of history Werfel and his MDEQ bosses would be on. Chapter 11, Public Health Enemy Number 1. In Flint, everybody knows the name Kettering. His inspiring quotes can be found on plaques and signs around the city. "Believe and act as if it were impossible to fail," are my personal favorite. "My interest is in the future because I am going to spend the rest of my life there." Our world-renowned engineering school in Flint, once called the General Motors Institute, is now named after Kettering, as are a number of honors and prizes given out in the city. There is a city near Dayton, Ohio, population 56,000, that was named after him too. It makes me a little sick now to remember how proud we were and how much we celebrated in 1992 when my dad received a Boss Kettering Award, GM's highest engineering award. Good old Boss Kettering. GM has tried to keep his flame alive. He was an engineer, an inventor, and the head of GM's research department for 27 years, from 1920 to 1947. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 1933. By most accounts, he was jocular and adventurous, loved by his family and friends, and his breakthroughs in automotive technology, including the invention of the modern car starter and the two-stroke diesel engine, made a lot of money for GM. Along with Alfred Sloan, the president of GM at the time, he helped to found Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and personally promised to oversee the organization of a cancer research program employing the most cutting-edge industrial techniques. But sometimes you have to look away from fanfare and familial love, corporate achievements, and even remarkable philanthropic work, and look at a person's entire legacy. Even I didn't know much about the man until I started doing more reading. I wasn't sleeping anyway. To my mind, there is no greater public health villain. Lead is probably the most widely studied neurotoxin, a metal that humans, including my ancient Assyrian ancestors, have been using for thousands of years. Even the word plumbing is derived from the Latin word for lead, plumbum. On the periodic table of elements, the symbol is PB. Its wonder was its remarkable malleability. The Romans used it to coat their famous aqueducts 2,000 years ago. It was also employed in almost every aspect of winemaking, something else the Romans were famous for. A food additive, it was sprinkled on everything, like salt. All this lead in the Romans' food, wine, and water has provoked theories that lead poisoning contributed to the fall of the empire. Since the first humans used lead, millions of tons of it have been dug from the earth and dispersed into the environment, far more than mercury or arsenic, the other two toxic trace elements. Aside from plumbing, its most widespread pre-industrial use was in paint, to make it washable, brighter, and much more durable. Art historians suspect lead pigments may have contributed to the illness and demise of many great painters, including Correggio, Raphael, and Goya. There's even a story that Vincent van Gogh was fond of the flavor of one pigment in particular and liked to suck on his paintbrushes. That wouldn't surprise a pediatrician. White lead is noted for its sweetness, which is why lead paint tastes so good to kids. Although lead was known to be poisonous and unhealthy even in ancient times, its convenience, particularly the durability of lead paint, created a conflict between public health advocates and industry that pretty much continued into the 20th century, as Christian Warren described so well in Brush with Death. Everybody knew lead was toxic, but what it did to the human body was insidious and invisible, while its benefit to industry was tangible and quantifiable in dollars. The story of lead in the United States, where industry has the upper hand, is a little different than in Europe. After childhood poisoning was linked to lead paint in 1904, several European countries banned its indoor use in 1909. But when the League of Nations banned lead paint in 1922, the United States declined to go along. At that point, the regulation of lead paint in this country was almost non-existent. Lead was big business in America. Given the rejection of lead in 1922 by most of the world, it's kind of amazing that just a year later it was added to gasoline in America. It was heralded as a giant technological breakthrough, a gift from God. It's funny how we talk about unleaded gasoline now, as if lead were a natural component of gas and removing it required a complicated chemical process, maybe even at great expense. The entire concept of unleaded is a misnomer, in fact. Lead was mined from the earth and added to gasoline. The reason? To stop engine knocking, an annoying noise in early car engines that occurred when the mix of fuel and air burned unevenly. According to GM legend, it took Kettering a decade of intense experimentation to find his anti-knock compound. He had alternatives, like ethanol, but it could not be patented and profited from, unlike tetraethyl lead, TEL, for which GM obtained the patent. The health hazard of TEL, over and above normal lead, was no secret. Fat-soluble and easily absorbed by the skin, TEL was even tested by the U.S. War Department as a nerve gas. Just 5 teaspoons applied to healthy skin could be fatal. 5 teaspoons on the skin. This didn't stop GM or even slow the company down, it seemed. It collaborated with DuPont and Standard Oil Exxon on a new high-octane style of gas, dubbed ethyl, that allowed cars to drive better and engines to work more efficiently, never to knock or ping. As soon as the coming of a new improved gasoline was announced, public health experts began writing about the dangers of lead. An anti-lead movement rose up and gained ground, as always seems to be the case, only in the aftermath of a tragedy. In October 1924, noxious fumes poisoned and killed workers in a section of a Standard Oil refinery in New Jersey where the new gasoline with TEL was being made. Several exposed workers were straitjacketed after exhibiting paranoid behavior, experiencing delusions, and becoming violent. When the first death occurred, 17 people died in all, the local district attorney called for an investigation, which launched a media frenzy. The tabloids referred to the lead fumes as loony gas. For the remainder of 1924 and most of 1925, the public health debate about tetraethyl lead in gasoline was one of the sharpest of the early century, much more heated than what eventually transpired over lead in paint, or than what has yet to transpire over lead in plumbing. Now I get to my favorite and the only uplifting part of the story. It's about Alice Hamilton, who lived in a time of Kettering and fought him with everything she had. Hamilton was a social justice pioneer, medical doctor, and professor who had specialized in lead toxicology cases among factory workers before turning her attention to GM. She pushed the company to find a better, safer alternative to TEL, and insisted that the introduction of lead on a widespread basis would have a catastrophic impact on public health. "I would like to make a plea to the chemists to find something else," she said at one public hearing. "I am utterly unwilling to believe that the only substance which can be used to take the knock out of a gasoline engine is tetraethyl lead." She was right. There were alternatives. But public health wasn't foremost in the corporate mentality. Profits were. Hamilton is now one of my heroes, a stubborn badass who devoted her life to improving the lives of workers, the poor, and children. When things became stressful for me in Flint, and there were some tough days to come, I thought of how hard she tried to right a wrong, to make the world safer for kids, and to prevent a totally preventable public health scourge. Hamilton was a visionary who studied medicine at the University of Michigan at a time when there were few women in the field. In her memoir, she said that her studies in Ann Arbor had been transformational. I could say the same thing about my time as an undergrad there. "Michigan gave Hamilton my first taste of emancipation," she said, "and I loved it. Ditto that." From there, Hamilton studied bacteriology and pathology in Germany from 1895 to 1897, just a few years before Paul Shaquana was in England. And she returned to the United States to continue her postgraduate studies at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Then she moved to Chicago to become a professor of pathology at the Women's Medical School of Northwestern University. In Chicago, she also became a member and resident of Hull House, the first settlement established by Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr, where newly arrived and impoverished European immigrants were given full or wraparound services, from healthcare to education and advocacy, and a safe place to live. Hamilton opened a well baby clinic and eventually expanded care to include children up to 8 years old. While at Hull House, she began touring city slums, mine shafts, and factories, researching industrial diseases and occupational hazards. She discovered more than 70 industrial processes and jobs that exposed workers to lead. When she was offered a position at Harvard Medical School in 1919, she was the foremost American authority on lead poisoning, and one of only a handful of specialists in industrial disease. But when Harvard University offered to hire her as its first woman professor, it made three stipulations. One, she was forbidden to enter the faculty club. Two, she could not have tickets to football games. Three, she was not allowed to march in the commencement procession. She took the job anyway. It's a lesson in strategic thinking, something she was especially good at. During Hamilton's years fighting lead in gasoline, she was adept at feeding tragic stories of lead poisoning to the popular media, knowing this would light fires that no academic study could. Between 1924 and 1926, the lead in gasoline controversy was debated in 124 daily newspaper articles in the New York City dailies that were picked up in hundreds of wire service stories around the country. When GM and Standard Oil pushed back, they claimed that Hamilton and other anti-lead activists were hysterical, that code word for stupid woman overreacting. While the industry's work to improve gasoline was based purely on rational science. The main medical expert defending GM's use of lead was its own in-house toxicologist, Dr. Robert Kehoe. At a conference called by Surgeon General Hugh Smith Cumming to resolve the conflict in May 1925, Kettering told his dramatic story of how he had experimented with dozens of additives and eventually discovered the wonders of TEL. As Alice Hamilton and other public health advocates looked on in horror and disgust, this mendacious testimony was followed by a succession of industry reps and medical experts backing up Kehoe's claims that TEL was totally safe and that there was no suitable alternative. He insisted that lead was naturally occurring in the environment and could be processed and eliminated by the human body without any health risk or danger. During a break in the conference, Hamilton is supposed to have confronted Kettering in the hallway and said, "You're nothing but a murderer." I'm not sure the story is true. It doesn't really go with her style, which was stubborn and persistent, but always polite. But I can only imagine how angry she might have been that day, face to face with such a liar. To conclude his testimony about the safety of Ethel, Kehoe made a diabolical offer. GM would discontinue use of TEL immediately if it could be proven to be harmful. This established a new precedent, later used by the asbestos and tobacco industries for decades, that forced public health advocates to prove harm before action could be taken. It goes against prudence and any sort of good judgment to allow dangerous practices to continue until enough evidence mounts to stop them, putting lives, even the planet, at risk. It was a turning point, not just in the history of lead, but in so many other aspects of public welfare and safety. Safe until proven dangerous became known as Kehoe's paradigm, or the Kehoe rule. The approach was later taken by climate change deniers. The public health approach, however, is far wiser than the Kehoe rule. The precautionary principle holds that a product or chemical should be considered unsafe unless the manufacturer can prove otherwise. To reach a decision in 1925, the Surgeon General called a small committee to investigate the hard evidence on leaded gasoline and to test workers for lead levels in their bodies. In 7 months of study,